On a show that talks about time traveling Bigfoot and alien sex cults, this is serious journalism, people.
Serious.
This time we mean it.
If you think that there are not birds that are not real, you're a moron.
At this point, I'm not throwing these weirdos out because maybe they're telling the truth.
Why does everything have to be a hidden conspiracy where the motives aren't really clear? Where you can't tell what someone's intentions are from their words? Why, Abby, why?
I feel like you're just not answering the question.
There is a pattern here that is definitive, and mm-hmm. This leads us to the CEO's response, which is not the way that you want to play being accused of in a conspiracy theory.
If jet fuel can melt steel beams, why can't it melt passports?
I'm just thinking to myself, like, who thinks like this? Oh, the United States government thinks like this.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Conspiracy Filled. It is season 4, episode 8. I'm Abby Libby. I'm here with PJ Williams. How's it going, PJ?
I'm doing good. How you doing, Abby?
I'm good. There's always this pause after the intro when I'm not sure when to start talking.
It's all good.
I don't see myself yet.
It's all good. They can't hear you when the intro's playing, so I just kind of like make it sound. Yeah. For people who listen to this on audio, I just make it sound better. Live, there's like a little bit of a gap. But you know what? You get so much for being here live, so thank you guys for showing up.
Yeah.
I love what's going on in the chat the over here. The awkwardness is the selling point of Conspiracy Pill, 100%. Yeah. So
I don't want to talk about the chat, though. It's already potty jokes. Already, somehow.
See what you guys are missing that listen to this show later? You're missing a chat full of potty jokes and butt sex magic and all kinds of insanity that happens over there.
Oh, man. Yeah.
I don't
think we're selling this very well.
No.
It's a totally normal chat that you would totally want to associate and hang out with people.
You would gain so much mentally, emotionally, spiritually from being here live and being in the chat. You guys have no idea what you're missing. Also, if you're not on Locals, you have no idea what you're missing. So thank you for all the people who come over and support us on Locals and keep the lights on. This week, we have one new local supporter. We have Hannah Hartz, who gave a one-time support of 3 months. So if you guys are missing out on the bonus unhinged content every week, you got to come over there. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the red heifers, which we're really excited for. I also see that Amy the Hokey Girl 77 is a new monthly supporter over here on Rumble. So if you guys do that, not only do you're supposed to get ad-free viewing. I don't know if it's come to the app yet, but we'll update you on that. I think on the live website, you do get it that way. And you also get bonus emotes for the chat. Your name's highlighted in the chat so we can see your comments pop up more. A lot of cool stuff. And honestly, it's the one way that you can support the show where we get 100%. Like the Rumble doesn't take any cut of that at all. So it's really helpful.
Nice.
You guys are awesome. So tonight I want to tell you guys about Hollow Earth, and I want to apologize for people who are here on Monday and heard me say something. I made a mistake, which is I should never say this is what we're doing next week, because every time I do, it does not happen. Every time, pretty much. So this is the third time this season that I made that mistake. I got to stop making that mistake. So Joel Thomas was supposed to be on with us tonight. I talked to him last night. He had a family emergency, so be praying for him. We're planning on getting him back soon. I'm not even going to say when, because then it won't happen. So we're planning on having him on soon to talk about his theory of there being some good Nephilim that are in the Bible that are hidden in there. And we're going to talk about that. So I'm very excited to have Joel Thomas on when he's able to join us. But tonight, I looked through your guys' suggestions over on Discord, and I saw over time, a lot of people have asked us to talk about Hollow Earth, and we've had, I feel like it's one thing that we've touched on here and there.
Yeah.
And we've never really done a full episode on it. We've talked about the Vril Society. We've talked about lizard people. We've talked about a little bit about Antarctica, and we'll get into some more of that tonight. But I really just wanted to go through the history of like how this theory came about, what are the different variations of this theory, and then get into like, is there science behind it? Is there a cover up behind it? Is NASA involved? All of those interesting things. So we're going to really get into it tonight. But I first want to start with a guy named Dallas Thomas. So on October 4th of 2002, Art Bell hosted Coast to Coast AM with this extremely enthusiastic guest. Like, Art was kind of, you could tell he was like, are you all right? Are you like jumping off the walls? But the guy's super like enthusiastic, excited, whatever you want to call it. Maybe he was on drugs. I don't know. But this guy claimed that he was a former personal trainer, that he spent his youth in Hawaii, and he now lived in Bakersfield, California. And 5 years earlier, he'd been driving along Highway 58 during a heavy rainstorm when his car hydroplaned, and he spun out four times and plunged backwards down a 250-foot drop. And his blue Honda Accord had been completely crushed. When the paramedics showed up, they said that they don't know how the guy wasn't decapitated, because it was just like smushed in, right? Like, he should not have lived through this. But during his time of being waiting to be rescued and being unconscious in his mangled car, he had this near-death experience. And he said he claimed to have seen a light that was so bright that it burned his eyes and made him legally blind. He then said that there was this strange new knowledge that was poured into him, that the earth was hollow and had an opening at the North Pole. So though the wreck left him legally blind, he had this mission to go out there and find the entrance to Hollow Earth. And he said, quote, there are cavern systems and caves that traverse the whole mantle. And because of this special atmosphere down in the Hollow Earth, he believed that living creatures were being protected from pollutants and harmful rays, that ancient tribes lived down there to be 1,700 years old. And he told Art that he had secured funding to go to the North Pole and go down the hole on a solo trek. Have you ever heard of a solo trek?
No.
Have you ever seen the movie Agent Cody Banks? That's a terrible example of a movie. I did see it when I was a kid, but this is a solo trek. It's this like a helicopter backpack thing, right?
Wow.
Yeah, so if you guys aren't
blind.
That was my favorite part of the story. Legally blind. So maybe he's got something. Yeah, but he's like, I'm blind and I'm also going to take a prototype. This is 2002, a prototype helicopter jetpack. Wow. And fly into the Hollow Earth at the North Pole.
The levels of illusion going on right now.
I gotta love this story. Okay. So over the next 2 months, he said that he was getting all of this support for his newly released book called Cosmic Manuscript. And he said he'd received over 5,000 emails since his appearance on Coast to Coast. And despite all of that, he said, quote, I've requested the book be discontinued, even though it's still at the top of the charts in Canada. And then he disappeared forever. No one's ever heard from this guy, seen him ever again, supposedly. So it's weird because, like, on one hand, I don't believe him at all. And then there's like, what happened to him? So there is some online speculation that he completely copied his book from someone else and then disappeared because he was worried about lawsuits and that he might not have even given a real name in the first place. Other people have tried to track him down so far unsuccessfully for the most part. But I just found this story really weird. So it's just one of the many, many, many stories about Hollow Earth. They go back to literally ancient concepts. And I want to just go over a few of them really quick. Obviously you've got all the underworld concepts, from, you know, Judaism, you have like Sheol, and in Christianity you have hell, and Greek mythology of Hades, which actually, if you read Greek mythology, Hades could actually be accessed from the surface through caverns. Like, it was a little different than more metaphysical concepts of hell and Sheol and the afterlife. Right. Even though I feel like a lot of people point to hell and Sheol as like, these are examples of Hollow Earth. And it's like, kind of like, imagery wise, it's been shown to be a place under the earth, but I don't think that like honest theologians are really thinking of it as a very physical location so much. We'll get more into people who do see it as a physical location in a bit, but it's different with Greek, right? With Hades and why can't I think of the deeper part of Hades?
Tartarus
and things like that, like physical locations, right?
But even then it's like you have to pass through the veil. Like, you have to cross.
Agreed. It's more like a portal thing. And I'm not through the sticks. It's a little bit more metaphysical.
Yeah.
But at least with that, you did have like actual, I think there were seven. I'm trying to remember the different, there's a lot of different mythologies, and I'm not going to spend too much time in mythology, but it's important to point out. There's another one in Ireland called, oh my gosh, Cruachan. I'm totally messing that up. It's also known as Ireland's Gates to Hell. And it's this mythical and ancient cave from which strange creatures would emerge and they'd be seen on the surface of the earth. So this one's a lot more like the type of Hollow Earth stuff that we've heard with lizard people and subterranean UFO bases and stuff like that. Also, I found in the Middle Ages, there was an ancient German myth that held that some mountain located between Eisenach and Gotha had a portal to the inner earth. So it's still portal, though, but interesting.
Interesting.
There's a Russian legend that says the Samoyeds, an ancient Siberian tribe, traveled to a cavern city to live inside the earth. And they just go on and on and on. There's like way too many to talk about. There's two important ones I want to get to really quick. And the first one, you've probably heard of both of these, but the first one's Shambhala. Have you heard of Shambhala? Shambhala? It's the ancient Buddhist tradition says that Shambhala is an ancient city that's located inside of the earth and that it will be the birthplace of Kalki, which is the next incarnation of Vishnu, who will usher in the new Satya Yuga age, essentially. So it goes into that whole like procession of cycles and ages and things like
I have a question.
Yeah.
How many words that you can't pronounce did you put into your notes?
Way too many. Just so people know. I did not have a lot of time. I think this is well researched, but like I didn't have a ton of time to do this. So I was talking to my wife last week and she's like, yeah, next time you write your notes, bring them to me and I'll help you pronounce everything. And then you can do your show. So I was going to do that this week, but I did not have. Yeah. Your sister over here saying I can't even pronounce Philadelphia as you guys keep correcting me. I'm just going to call it Philly. How's that? Is that cool for everybody?
If you have to, whatever you got to do.
So there's Shambhala. And there's another one that comes up a lot in Hollow Earth stuff called Argata or Argatha. And this one is actually not ancient at all. It's frequently confused with Shambhala, but it originates in the 19th century with a French occultist. Again, I didn't even put his name in my notes because I couldn't pronounce that. I knew that. But it was revived in the right after World War I by guess who? Pretty.
Madame, what's her face?
No. Well, close enough. The Thule Society, Nazis.
Oh, well, yes.
Right. Valid. So the Thule Society was kind of like, you know, the male, there's kind of a male and female version of like the early Nazi occultists, and you have the Thule Society, and then you have the Vril Society. And if you remember, the Vril Society comes from this old unnamed who wrote it book called Vril, and then it was revived in the Shaver Mysteries. It was called the Shaver Mysteries, and I forget which magazine it is, Pulp Magazine. And that's where the concept of these underground lizard people comes from. This is where you said her name a second ago, but Blavatsky got her ideas about the lizard people from partially from Hinduism, I think, and then also from Vril, the Vril occultist book. But that's where a lot of like those inner earth, you know, subterranean ideas come from. And Hitler came up a lot in this episode, but I'm actually not going to focus on him. There's all these different beliefs on like, did Hitler believe the earth was flat or not flat? Did he believe it was hollow? Did he believe it was concave? Did he believe there was secret underground, you know, Jewish lizard people down there? Probably. if he was Jewish lizard people. well, if you pay attention, again, we talked about this in the past, but like Blavatsky, people kind of forget the whole idea that like the underground lizard people in her mythology were like the lesser Jewish race, you know? So of course Hitler liked that one. So I don't want to focus too much on the aliens and lizard people and all that stuff. I want to talk about history and all scientific possibilities. And it really starts with a guy named Edmund Halley. And I'm going to say Halley, even though I kept listening to videos that said Halley and it's spelled with two L's and that's probably true, but nobody says Halley's Comet in America. So I'm not saying it.
Yeah.
He's gay. It's so gay. He is a famous English astronomer. He's a mathematician. He's a physicist. And I actually have a picture of him right here. And this picture, we'll come back to this in a second, but this is him holding his famous Hollow Earth concept on a page. He's kind of known for this, but what else he's known for besides all of that, is that he was the second astronomer royal in Britain, or royal astronomer in Britain. Mm-hmm. He succeeded a guy named John Flamsteed in 1720. And he also, like I mentioned a second ago, discovered a little known comet you probably never heard of. Halitosis, I think, is the name of the comet. Yeah.
Got it.
He was also BFFs with Isaac Newton. Did you know that about Edmund Halley?
I knew that when you said it before
just
the show.
Now. Okay, just before the show. So he helped Newton write, finance, and promote his magnum opus called Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, whatever. It's known as the Principia. That's like how it's said. But it was, it was where Newton expounded on the laws of motion and his laws of universal gravitation. Like, this is what Newton is known for. And Haley, you know, I'm saying it wrong, even though I said I wasn't going to say it that way.
Yeah.
Haley, I'm trying. Haley got to know Newton and helped him kind of develop his theories a little bit. And then, like I said, he financed his book and helped him in all this. He's kind of an underwritten hero in all of that. But he also spent a year sailing around the world studying a thing called magnetic declination. And I know I kind of told you about this before the show, but for people who don't know, I was going to explain it, but there's actually a short little video. It's 48 seconds long, and I think it's better if I just play this. But if you've ever done sailing or land navigation or anything like that, you know what this is. It's the difference between true north and magnetic north. So here, let's check out this video really quickly.
You might not have known that magnetic north is not the same as true north. And magnetic north is always changing over time. Currently, it's drifting away from northern Canada and towards Siberia. The magnetic north pole is where your compass needle points. So depending on where and when you are on Earth, the difference in angle between your needle and the direction of true north will change. This is why topographic maps give you a magnetic declination. It's the angle between magnetic north and true north for the region covered by your map at a specific time. Since it's changing over time, it's best to look up the most recent declination reading online for the area before heading out. A quality compass will have adjustable declination, so you can set it and forget it.
Yes, they do, and I've used it. So you'll notice that in this video, they don't say why this occurs. And none of the videos I found anywhere on the internet actually said what causes magnetic declination. But I want to come back to that at the end of the episode.
Is it your mom? Or
It's the gravitational pull of your mother, yes. I wasn't going to... Thanks for spoiling it, but...
Sorry.
Yeah, if she's close by, your magnet's just going to wildly shift towards her poles. Exactly. Or whatever pole she's dancing on that night.
Oh, that was too good. All right.
So, we'll talk more about that later, but... To solve for this strange phenomena, Haley proposed that there were not just two poles, the one your mom dances on and the one for the day, for the night shift, because your mom's the day shift dancer.
That's so true.
They're not just two poles, one in the north and the south, but he said there's actually two more that lived inside of the Earth. And this was kind of the first... not the first, but the first time it was probably called Hollow Earth. This is like the origins of like modern science. I say modern because it's, it is still in the modern age, technically, right? Of science, scientific exploration. So it was the kind of the modern version of Hollow Earth brought into the scientific community. And he conjectured that the Earth might consist of a hollow shell that was about 500 miles thick, so half as thick as your mom. And two inner concentric shells and an innermost core. So again, going back to this picture, you can see he's holding...
I really don't want to talk about your mom's innermost core. But.
Yeah, no, I don't think anybody wants to talk about my mom's innermost core, but...
the opportunities keep coming.
This show is just off to a great start. So he believed that these shells in the Earth were moving, and they were moving different than the shell on the outside of the Earth. And that was causing the magnetic declination, that one, your magnet was sensing the pole on the other side. Right. So it wasn't sensing true north anymore.
Ooh.
He also believed that the Earth was separated by these shells, and that there was, they were all rotating at different speeds, and he envisioned that there was atmosphere between the shells that was luminous and possibly inhabited. This part's interesting because this is the thing that he gets knocked on the most for. This is the part that he, there's two reasons for this, basically. At the time, there was the modern belief was that the moon was much denser than the Earth. So they were also trying to solve for, like, why is the Earth so much bigger but yet less dense than the moon? And that had to do with, like, physics and astronomy and things like that. And I don't even want to get into the mathematics of it, but he was solving for that. And he was also a religious man. So he believed that, at the time it was believed that God had created life everywhere. And the only way that he could have created life on other planets, to some anyway, which could create life on other planets, was for them to live inside of those planets. So he believed, well, if our Earth is full of these shells, that it would also be teeming with life because God is, you know, wants there to create as much life as possible. Right.
Sure.
So there's kind of, that part was kind of, a little bit more religious belief, but I just want to, again, here's a picture of his, like, concentric rings of Atlantis.
The whole Earth is Atlantis.
Atlantis does come up a little bit in this. I didn't go too far into the Atlantis thing, but it's just because there's so many theories about Hollow Earth dating from Edmund Halley to today that, of course, UFOs and Atlantis and lizard people, they all come up at some point in somebody's version of or another. And he also said that the escaping gas emitted by the poles was what caused the Aurora Borealis, which is another one where it's like, it's one of those, we kind of know maybe, but it's not really actually a settled science as much as everybody thinks it is about the Aurora Borealis. I didn't want to get too into it, so I just brought that up there. And again, like, if you listen to videos on Edmund Halley, they'll just say, look, he was brilliant, but he was a product of his time. And this whole Hollow Earth thing was really dumb. And the idea that the Earth was layered with things that were spinning at different, you know, than each other was all big and stupid and whatever. And they just, like, they excuse away this whole concept of his. But I just, I don't see the, like, if you're watching, like, he's so much closer in his theory then. What I'm showing for people who are listening is his picture looks like the way that we dissect the Earth now and say, oh, there's not atmosphere between, you know, this and that and the other's magma and molten things. And there's an inner sun type core. So I just find it funny that as much crap as he gets, like,
he was right.
He was basically, even according to the modern scientific standard, he was basically right. Sans the idea that the rings had large gaps of atmosphere between them, but everything else, like his concentric rings, look exactly like the way that we think of the layers of the Earth now, the crust and the mantle and the, all of that stuff, right? Going down to the inner core. And if you look over the last 10 or 20 years, I'm not even going to get into this because it's basic elementary stuff. You can look it up yourself. Like, there's the amount of layers is constantly changing. Like, they're like, well, actually there's a continental layer and then there's the mantle and then there's this, and then there's the core and an inner core. And then there's two types of mantle. And we'll get more into the science of, like, the layers later, but I just find it funny that, again, like, pretty spot. Like, if this is believed of the Earth now, to make fun of his idea of it being almost exactly the same a few hundred years ago, I find really, really interesting. So, the next guy I want to talk about is a guy named John Cleve Sims Jr., which, you know, everybody knows this guy. Everybody knows good old John Cleve Sims Jr.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. He's like way more well-known than Edmund Halley, for sure.
I mean, I don't like Mr. Sims Sr. so much, but
yeah, he's kind of a dick.
Pretty cool.
Jr. is pretty cool. He was an American Army officer, a trader, and a lecturer, and he's labeled the Newton of the West by his followers and basically no one else. Just his most ardent followers call him the Newton of the West.
My followers call me the Newton of the West.
Yeah, pretty much. So in 1818, he proposed his own variant of the Hollow Earth theory. And he said, quote, I declare the Earth is hollow and habitable within, containing a number of solid concentric spheres, one within the other, and that it is open at the poles 12 or 16 degrees. I pledge my life in support of this truth, and I'm ready to explore the hollow if the world will support and aid me in the undertaking. And he sent his declaration to, quote, each notable foreign government, reigning prince, legislature, city, college, and philosophical societies throughout the Union, and to individual members of our national legislature as far as 500 copies would go.
So he
like really, really believed that he was right about the hollow earth and just was sending it out to everybody.
You know what? Props to somebody who is either so unaware or does not care how weird his theory is and is just not embarrassed about it at all and just like shoots his shot.
Yeah, I kind of love it. So his was close to Edmund Halley's, except he visualized the earth crust as being approximately 1,000 miles thick. So the exact same width as your mom, with the Arctic opening about 4,000 miles wide and the Antarctic opening around 6,000 miles wide.
I don't want to talk about the opening speech. How many times do I have to tell you this?
I feel like he's just describing a picture of your mom. So it's the curvature of the rim of these polar openings were gradual enough in his theory that it would be possible to actually enter the inner earth without realizing it. So basically the gravity, the earth's rotation would just like stay with you as you curve, just like it does on the outside, but as you go on the inside. So what he's describing essentially is he's kind of describing like a donut almost, right? Like this, this is because he said it would actually cause the earth to be flatter at the poles. So if you think about it, if people watching, I pulled up a picture, not actually of a donut, I almost did that, but like it's a little bit more smushed down in these huge wide openings in the middle and you could walk around the inside. Again, it's basically donut earth, like was his theory. So gotta love it. He said the centrifugal force of the earth's rotation would be flattened at the poles, leading to a vast passage into the inner earth. Again, 4,000 miles wide at the top, 6,000 miles wide at the bottom. You guys can fill in the joke in chat. he said these polar openings would be his, or these polar openings would be his main contribution to the theory, and they would become known as Sims holes. And there's this Sims holes are wide gaping holes is what we're supposed to know. Basically what this guy added to hollow earth theory is that where a hole should be, there is a pole, or where a pole should be, there is a hole. So modern day transgender
Western Newton,
he was way ahead on the putting a hole where there should be a pole. Way ahead of his time. This was Dylan Mulvaney's biggest inspiration was Sims holes.
Yep. Amazing. Amazing stuff.
Go ahead.
Oh, one of my lights went off.
All right. Thai guy burgers and fries with a $2 rumble rant says Sims sphincters. I like that. Yeah, that's really great. So thank you for that.
We have to read chats just because people paid for them. Is that how we're doing it?
But we'll see. We'll see. Putting a hole where it should be a pole is definitely LGBTQ agenda. Yeah, he was way out of his time, guys.
Yeah.
But his concept would be made more famous later on by a certain Admiral Byrd. We've talked about this guy a little bit before. And I'm going to say this up front. This is going to be a very condensed version because we're going to go over his whole thing in a greater detail when we actually finally do the episode. The other episode you've been asking us for, which is Antarctica. So the short version of this is in 1946, the U.S. government initiated Operation High Jump, which was to establish Antarctic Research Base. And it was led by Rear Admiral Richard E. Byrd. And it was supposed to last 6 to 8 months, but they reached the Antarctica on December 12th, 1946, and they pulled out February of 1947.
So the jokes keep coming. I'm just letting them go.
You just go for it.
Rear Admiral pulled. Okay.
Yeah. Rear Admiral pulled out. Yeah, I know. So he, on the way back, stopped in Chile, and he discussed the lessons that he learned from this operation, an interview with Lee Van Atta of the International News Service. And the interview appeared Wednesday, March 5th, 1947, in the Chilean newspaper El Mercurio. And I'm just going to read a part of it. It says, it has been translated from Spanish to English, obviously, but it says, Admiral Richard E. Byrd warned today that the United States should adopt measures of protection against the possibility of an invasion of the country by hostile planes coming from the polar regions. The admiral explained that he was not trying to scare anyone, but the cruel reality is that in case of a new war, the United States could be attacked by planes flying over one or both poles. The statement was made as a part of a recapitulation of his own polar experience in an exclusive interview with the International News Service talking about the recently completed expedition. Byrd said that the most important result of his observation and discoveries is the potential effect they have in relation to the security of the United States. The fantastic speed with which the world is shrinking, recalled the admiral, is one of the most important lessons learned during his recent Antarctic exploration. I have to warn my compatriots that the time has ended when we were able to take refuge in our isolation and rely on the certainty that the distances, the oceans, and the poles were a guarantee of our safety. So that part is 100% real, like that interview, right? So he's talking about like, hey, there might be a threat from the North and South Poles that we weren't foreseeing. And obviously, we're not going to go into like, did Hitler escape to Antarctica and build a base and all that stuff? But he was, to know a little bit more about Byrd for the purposes of this story, he was originally famous for being the first man to fly over the North Pole in 1927. He allegedly had reported about a mysterious land beyond the North Poles. And then he flew over the South Pole in 1929 and 1933. He did expeditions there in 1935 and throughout the 40s and even up to 1955, 2 years before he died in 1957. So this guy had been to both poles and he'd been to Antarctica and led expeditions there a lot. And his fame really came originally from being the guy who flew over the North Pole first. So that's kind of how he got into that position, right? So in 1996, his journals were published detailing all these trips to Antarctica and the North Pole, except that his 1947 expedition in Operation High Jump was missing. And it's never been released, this journal, because he always kept one on all his expeditions. Right. And we have all of them except this one. Awesome. And there's even speculation that we don't really have all of them because there are erased parts in his 1927 memo or his 1927 thing. So like, there's some redacting most likely happening with what he actually found and saw at both poles. So there is a journal, I think it was released in 1964, that's supposed to be his missing journal, right? Like the one that they didn't have. And I'm not going to go super into like whether it's real or fake. I didn't have a ton of time to like spend on Admiral Byrd, but the story basically goes that he was flying. His journal describes that the temperature starts getting warmer as he approaches the South Pole. And as he lands, it's 74 degrees and it's just full of lush green forests, right? And now that he's landed, these beings from the inner earth come up and they talk to him. They take him down into the inner earth and they explain that, you know, they're getting more involved since nukes, which is, again, is like every post-World War II alien story ever. And what the big thing that comes out of this is the belief that one of the things that he supposedly said in this journal is that the planes could actually traverse through the flat, through the middle of the hollow earth and go from pole to pole in like a super short time. There's like this super speedy highway between, you know, the north and the south. And again, it's like this donut shaped image. I'm going to point this out to all the people who love to talk about Richard Byrd for their flat earth episodes. None of that makes any sense on a flat earth model. Just throwing that out there. If you really, 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 really believe Richard Byrd and this journal is his, you kind of can't use it for your flat earth theory. Just throwing that out there. But it does actually fall into hollow earth theory. And I find that so funny that like this is actually where his stuff belongs, but yet he's brought up in flat earth stuff over and over and over again. You know,
because flat earthers pick and choose what pieces of evidence that they want to consider without being any type of coherent or
so this is why this one's so much more interesting to me, because I'm not even proposing that the earth is actually hollow, but I think there's some interesting stuff here. Like we already pointed out with Edmund Halley, even if the earth wasn't hollow and didn't have these gaps of air, his theory on basically what's going on under the surface was so much more accurate than anybody of his time, and he doesn't get credit because they don't like the term hollow earth. The scientific community doesn't. So
it's funny what things scare the scientific community and what things don't.
So much of this does, and it makes me think that we'll get into the science at the end of this episode, but yeah, there's definitely something much more interesting here than I think with the flat earth stuff. So, the question then becomes like, if this is all nonsense, why in 1948 the U.S. government make a documentary about how Operation High Jump that they called, oh, hold on, I have a picture here, The Secret Land, which is pretty interesting already, yeah. You know, that like after Operation High Jump, they got this movie. It's completely filmed by the military. It's promoted and funded completely by the United States government. And the film reenacts scenes from several critical moments during the operation, including the rescue of a crew of a crashed aircraft and the discovery of an Antarctic oasis of bare ground and ice-free freshwater lakes atop a thermal bulge deep inland. So when people talk about this idea that there might be this like lush green oasis in the center of Antarctica, and that's why it's, you know, being doctored, yeah, possibly in these NASA photos of satellites and things like that, why we're not allowed to go there, and even the celebrities that go to Antarctica are just like hang out on the edges and they just can't really see what's deep, yeah, inland. I do find it funny the government in 1948 is like, oh yeah, remember that time that's that Richard Byrd saved someone from the forests in the middle of Antarctica? Like, that's weird, right?
Yeah. Eden, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah,
maybe. But the weird part is how many times the Bible says in the east, in the east, in the east, in the east.
We'll definitely do an episode on, yeah, we'll definitely do an episode on the Garden of Eden at some point. But I just find it interesting that we might not actually know as much about Antarctica as we think we do, I think is the kind of takeaway there. At very least, it's just weird propaganda. Like, what were they trying to push that theory, like that idea of a lush green forest in the middle of Antarctica for? If it's not propaganda, then... And it just happened to be truth they hadn't like redacted and tried to hide yet. It's all weird, right? So I want to go back in time a little bit to a guy named Jeremiah Reynolds. And this guy kind of picked up where Sims left off. He was a true believer of Sims, and he worked to organize a scientific exploration of the poles. So, I realize I'm just setting you up for all kinds of jokes tonight.
Yeah, keep my mouth shut.
All right. So in his belief... He was trying to get Congress to fund, you know, a scientific exploration to the North Pole, to the South Pole, and all this stuff. But he knew that people weren't ready to believe in Hollow Earth. So he emphasized the general economic benefits of polar exploration. He argued that the voyage would be worth it, you know, just for discovery and whatever they could discover. And he didn't even really push the... People knew who he was, but he wasn't going in front of Congress and pushing the idea of the Hollow Earth so hard. So in 1827, he won the support of the John Quincy Adams administration, and they commissioned the USS Peacock to explore the mysterious waters of the South Pole. And this is before, supposedly, the continent of Antarctica had even been discovered, which I say sort of, because we've also talked in the past about like ancient maps that show Antarctica
having,
before
accurately,
exactly,
the edges of the...
Yeah, and that's all before like the Western world officially discovered Antarctica. So like, as far as the people of his time, there was no landmass found and mapped, but the ancients probably did find and map Antarctica. Yeah.
Right.
So the military didn't like this guy, so they proceeded to slow walk the project until 1828. And that's when John Quincy Adams was defeated by Andrew Jackson. So Andrew Jackson becomes president, and he just vetoes it, like tanks the whole idea. So he goes around and he's gathering funding to do this exploration on his own. And he was eventually able to hire two sloops, and he sets out for the South Pole. And the sailors on his ship hated him so much that they threatened to mutiny. And the captain then decided that he didn't want to be mutinied against. So he threw Reynolds, he abandoned Reynolds in Chile. And just went home. They just abandoned the whole mission. They're just like, yep, you're going to stay here in South America and screw you. Apparently, some of it was because he kept telling them that it would get warmer the closer they got to Antarctica. And, they were probably not prepared for what it actually was. So they turned around and dropped him off and went home and said, screw you, right? So, but he did use his time in Chile wisely, because he wrote this story about a great white whale that he had heard tales from when he was down there. And he titled it... Do you want to guess what the title of this is?
Moby Dick.
It's Mocha Dick, or The White Whale of the Pacific. This is a real book.
I was not...
This is actually the book that Moby Dick is based on. It's called Mocha Dick, and it's based on real tales of a great white whale with all these spears sticking out of it. So this guy actually wrote like the first version, essentially, of Herman Melville's classic Moby, like what it was based on, at least. So basically, Moby Dick was based on Mocha Dick, which was based on a Chilean folklore. Maybe it was true. Yeah. Who knows? But like, this is what the sailors were telling him about when he was down there.
I can see why Moby Dick would sell better than this particular title.
Mocha Dick sounds like a really bad black porn star name. So
yeah, or a really great black porn star name.
Yeah, let's go with that. So, but this guy, this most hated Hollow Earth psychopath, was not the only classic American literature that he inspired. It was not just Moby Dick.
Seriously?
Yes. Yeah. This is crazy. He was friends with supposedly Edgar Allan Poe. There is concrete proof that they knew each other, mm-hmm. and there's speculation that they remained friends for all of these reasons. But in 1838, Edgar Allan Poe wrote the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket.
Mm.
And it featured a mutinous crew, and it ends with the discovery of a warm, strange sea surrounding the South Pole. So he's basing this off this guy's adventures.
So many of these authors around this time are writing about all of these ideas that we've since rejected. Like you know, Jules Verne did so much. Yeah. Journey to the Earth, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Arthur Conan Doyle, we talked about last week, did The Lost World.
Yep.
With dinosaurs and stuff on this high plateau. And then Edgar Allan Poe.
This is not the only time, because Edgar Allan Poe has a really interesting story about time travel that we'll talk about in a future episode that's like wild.
H.G. Wells did a Hollow Earth Type 1 time machine.
Yep. There's a lot. I didn't put all the examples of, but the next thing I was going to talk about after this was Journey to the Center of the Earth, so we'll come back to that. But yeah, there's so many good examples. So Edgar Allan Poe writes a story, and then do you know much about his demise, Edgar Allan Poe?
There's
a whole mystery behind it. It probably deserves its own episode. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah.
But the long and short of it is this, that when he was Edgar Allan Poe was found semi-conscious on the streets of Baltimore on October 3rd, 1849. Mm-hmm. And he was basically incoherent for the next 4 days. And on the night before his death, he's said to have repeatedly shouted the name Reynolds over and over and over again.
Reynolds.
Yeah. So no one know, like even the people that were with him that were witnessing him die and trying to bring him back to life had no idea who this Reynolds was.
Right.
So there are four main theories, and I'm not getting into all of them, but one of them is that it was Jeremiah Reynolds that he based his book off of.
It's not a huge stretch to think that somebody you wrote a book about might be a name you're yelling in the streets.
Yeah. So pretty interesting stuff. I mean, I find that all interesting that maybe Edgar Allan Poe, had bought into and believed this Hollow Earth theory. Either way, such what a weird guy that no one's ever heard of. And he inspires all this fiction at the time. Right. And another piece of fiction that was possibly inspired, not by him, but was definitely inspired by Sims, is what you said, Jules Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth, 1864. Mm-hmm. And this is what describes a journey into the Earth's interior via a fictional Icelandic volcano named Skaftáris. Have you actually read this? I've actually never read this book.
Journey to the Center of the Earth?
Yeah. Have you read it?
Yes.
Do you like it?
Verne's writing is scientific, dry in a scientific way. So if you like reading something that it's like feels really real because it's so sciencey worded,
so
even in its like wildness, yes.
So you'd say it's more like, I can't think of the author's name that wrote not the other Lost World, the Jurassic Park one.
Oh yeah, Crichton. Michael Crichton.
Michael Crichton, yeah. Is it more like a Crichton book? Okay. So Jules Verne is probably would have been considered like sci-fi, but that wasn't even a term back in this time.
Yeah.
So that's pretty interesting. In this book, they travel to the center of the earth. Well, not exactly the center. They don't reach all the way to the center, but they discover a subterranean ocean that's inhabited by all these creatures they thought were extinct. And they escape through another volcano on the Italian island of Stromboli.
Mm-hmm.
So this is probably the most famous. It's inspired movies and things. And it even inspired at least the title of this other nonfiction book from 1913 called A Journey to the Earth's Interior, which I love. It's like, So close. It sounds like the Kmart version of Jules Verne.
My favorite adaptation, if you're interested in Journey to the Center of the Earth, my favorite adaptation is the Brendan Fraser movie that...
I've never actually seen that one. I like Brendan Fraser, too.
The setup is that it's a second journey to the center of the earth. They're following Verne, like Jules Verne's instructions down. So it's not the same story, but it's the same setting. It's really good.
Yeah.
You're Brendan Fraser.
Ty Guy asks, is there an Italian island called Stromboli? I think that might have been a fictional name too, but I'm wrong. I don't know. Because the volcano Scartaris is fake. So maybe Stromboli. I don't know. Stromboli. I was like, is that a food? Anyway.
Yeah.
So A Journey to the Earth's Interior is in fact not a Kmart B-movie version of A Journey to the Center of the Earth. It's when Marshall Gardner wrote a book that was also titled Have the Poles Really Been Discovered? And this is where he proposed his own, I keep wanting to say flat earth theory, hollow earth theory, in which the interior of the sun is in the middle of the earth, right? So this is like... Yeah, it's like full on hollow earth, as in like when you go into this earth, it's like reversed, right? And there's like this big, you know, 600 mile wide interior and all this stuff. And you're just like, people are living in a convex version inside of the earth, right? So he even patented his idea, and it's US patent 10961 02 A. And here's a picture of it. And I was going to read parts of this to you guys here. It's not that great of a picture. But there's like this whole text here and you can read it for yourself, but it feels unhinged by what I think he's basically proposing. What I was able to gather from it is he patented his version of Hollow Earth in a globe that he could sell, where like it would peel apart and you could like open it like a Polly Pocket house, like a dollhouse or something, like, and like see the interior parts of the earth and like the sun floating in the middle, all of that. So like he quite literally got a patent for his idea on Hollow Earth, which I find very interesting.
Amazing.
And just really quickly, this is kind of the picture that's off. Pictures like this are often used to depict this type of hollow earth, again with the sun in the middle and all these like cities. And as you can see, the names that come up over and over and over again through all these fiction and nonfiction type books about hollow earth is right here. You got the city of Shambhala, which is Buddhist, and then you have somewhere on here is Agartha.
Like right in the big letters.
Oh yeah, right there in the big letters. So in some versions, Agartha is the entire flat, like the country perhaps of the Hollow Earth. And then this, they're the city of Shambhala and whatever others, you know, they may name one Sheol and all these other things, try to like make it work. But here you've got basically, again, you've got the entrances at the North and South Poles, but then inside you've got this like convex, you know, complete inner earth. And this kind of leads to another thing that is called concave hollow earth. Have you heard of this one?
I don't know. I get convex and concave mixed up.
Well, it's called both. Wait, I think. No, is convex the opposite of concave? I don't know. But let me put it this way. This was first proposed by a guy named Cyrus Teed. He was a doctor from upstate New York in 1869, and he called it cellular cosmology. This has also been known as sky centrism, and it's basically an inside out version of the earth. So if you've ever played like Halo, it's basically like a Halo ring, except the whole thing. So instead of, which is more Marshall Gardner's idea that we live on the outside of the earth and we can witness this by looking at the stars and the sun and how it moves around us, his theory is basically, no, we're actually all being lied to. We all live inside the earth, and it actually curves the opposite way of what we think. So it's like, you know how like flat earth always tries to like come up with a way to not trust the laser tests that prove that the earth is actually curving. In their version, the lasers and light actually move around the sun. So if you tried to like use a laser level test to prove that the earth is not in fact convex or concave, it would just like float around. It's so weird. But like, according to this theory, human beings live on the inside of the planet, not on the outside. And the sun is this great battery operated contraption, and the stars are just reflections, whatever, of the light. So he's got this whole flat earth kind of cosmology feel to it.
Nice.
And this guy, Cyrus Teed, called his belief and his ideas Corsianity. And as a distant relative of Joseph Smith, he did apply the family trade, and he created his own religion, called Corsianity. And he preached cellular cosmology, alchemy, reincarnation, immortality through celibacy, communism, and all this other stuff, right?
Like, that's a new one. It's not a cult where you have sex with all women. Immortality through celibacy.
I didn't spend a ton of time on this, but well, I'll come back to that. So
I don't believe you.
I'll come back to that. I almost did. I was like, oh yes, another alien sex cult. We'll just include it. But I summed it up because I thought maybe this is a future episode material. So he had this idea called Corsian Unity. And he formed this communist utopia that he based on all these ideas. By the way, I didn't go into it, but like if you read all of the different Hollow Earth things going back hundreds of years, so many of them, and I mean more than 50% of them, are really stories about communal utopian ideas, right? There's like a 1907 book that's like the first feminist utopian novel, and it's Hollow Earth. And like... what's another one? There's Casanova wrote a Hollow Earth book like a long ass time ago about these like hermaphroditic midgets living inside of the earth. It's an 1800 page book too. I wish I was making that up, but I didn't even include it in my notes. So
H.G. Wells's people in the earth were also midgets.
Hermaphroditic midgets or
no?
Oh, these are like my gosh. I just realized multicolored hermaphroditic midgets. It's like the Raelians. Anyway, so
yeah, H.G. Wells's midgets were pedo bait midgets. They looked very childlike.
Yeah, yeah.
And were sexy.
Your sister says Casanova's Hollow Earth was for sure not a celibate one.
That's fair.
Sorry, I think it's dwarves, not midgets. Whatever. It's, you get what I'm saying. So
wow, racist.
In Corish Unity. This guy, Cyrus Teed, of course, was the new Messiah. And in his religion, God was a hermaphrodite. The rest of the... I'm trying to think how to say this. I looked into this thinking we found ourselves another alien sex cult. And perhaps we did. Perhaps. But because basically his idea is I'm the Messiah, God's a hermaphrodite, and the only just way... is women are so downtrodden. What we really need is if I'm at the center of 12 female judges who will like rule over these people and you all cannot have sex with them. And it never says that he's exempt from the celibacy rule, but it does say there were secret rooms in the compound no one was allowed to go into. So I'm guessing he was just making everyone else celibate so he could have the 12 hottest classic of his cults. Yeah. So this cult went from New York to Chicago, ended up in Florida. Because none of the adherents were having children, they kind of just, faded out.
Got it.
So there's no Koresh in Unity. And no, it is not related to David Koresh. I know how much that sounds the same, but
amazing.
I'm probably even saying it wrong. Koresh in Unity. Anyway, so let me put it this way. You can't have a really good conspiracy without a alien based sex cult in there somewhere.
Okay. That's fine.
You know, so
there's always a sex cult. There's always a military base. There's always, what was it?
Indigenous people.
And there's always sky jelly.
I think we have literally all of those in this episode. Maybe not the sky jelly, but there's definitely, if we go back to like ancient American Indian beliefs, there's stories there too of their people coming up out of the ground. There's actually two stories that are very popular in like different Native American mythologies. And one is that they came descended from the star people. The other one was that they came up from the ground people. So we do have the Native American stuff. We definitely have the sex cult now. What was the other one? Military base. We have the military base, Operation High Jump in Antarctica. We just need some freaking star jelly or something, I think. So.
Yeah, we need some fungus? jelly fungus?
You're talking about it's Nostoc. We need Nostoc. We need troll snot, which is jelly, whatever it's called. Yeah.
Yes.
I should have looked for it. So wait. We do.
We have Nostoc?
We do. Kind of. Yeah. We'll get to it in a minute. So obviously you've got the traditional hollow earth theory and then all its variations. You've got concave earth theory. But I think the one that most people focus on, what I want to focus on for the rest of the episode, is really not so much hollow earth, even though it's grouped in. It's called inner earth theory. And this is that the earth is solid, but it has this honeycombed interconnected spaces. So basically secret tunnels, you know, like... Yeah, just full of secret tunnels, right?
Secret Jewish tunnels.
It's the yes. It's the Jews. Yeah, for sure. So
we need like a banner that you guys
are
like, the Jews.
We need an alert thing every time and just hit a button. It's like the Jews. Yeah, I like it. So so seismic activity is essentially how scientists claim they know the Earth is not hollow. And I was struggling to find like a condensed, really good explanation of it. This is maybe the closest. Let's try that. Let's check this one. That's only a minute long.
Seismic waves are generated by earthquakes. For example, two tectonic blocks suddenly slip. There is energy that's generated by that earthquake, and that it moves through the earth in the form of seismic waves. We record the ground motion by sensitive instruments called seismographs. Some researchers use seismic waves as a tool to basically study the interior of the Earth. In the same way that the medical doctors use X-rays to look at the interior of the patient's body. Apart from seismologists who use seismic waves that penetrate deep in the Earth's interior, there are also mineral physicists who use experimental setting to look at the behavior of rocks at high pressures and high temperatures.
Oh, so yeah, basically, I spent a lot of time looking into these different videos with all the explanations, but the one thing that I kept coming across is as much as you'll read that the Earth's layers are settled and we know them 100% for sure, even though it keeps changing every few years, even though we're constantly updating this, that it's really not a very exact science at all. It basically started with them just waiting for an earthquake and then measuring the earthquake and like making assumptions based on that.
Well, like not only do you have to make assumptions about the data, you have to make assumptions about, like you have to assume your theory is correct.
With no possible way to test it, because the only way they can go with the theory is if they believe they know what the contents of the earth are made out of, and that would affect their math.
Right.
Basically, they say that seismic waves will move differently through granite, they'll move differently through these different layers, molten magma and all these things. So if it is what they think it is, they can map certain things, but this is a incredibly, incredibly new and imprecise science.
Right.
And the one thing that I 100% agree with them on is that the earth is not fully hollow. That's basically what they've proven, is the earth is thick, right? It's like Abby's mom. It's thick, but maybe a little too thick. And but it doesn't mean that we actually know what's like really going on underneath the earth's surface. And I've got a few examples of that. One of the first ones is a thing called Verevoivkina Cave, which is the deepest cave system in the entire world that we know of. And it is 7,257 feet at its deepest known part.
That's deep.
It took 50 years and 30 expeditions for Russian cavers to reach its record depth in 2018. So not even that long ago. Even they believe that the caves just keep going and that it's way deeper than they've been able to figure out so far. So after 50 years, they've gotten down to the point where, well, it's at least 7,200 feet deep. It's at least a mile and a half deep, right? But we think it goes way further.
Wow.
So the Earth's crust is believed to be up to 43 feet thick in different places. And seismology is famously bad at detecting caves. So there's up to, again, if we know caves can go that deep and we believe that the Earth's crust stays basically the same for up to 43 miles deep, does seismology tell us where caves are? Not really, because there's this thing called SBRs, which is a string of bead-like reflectors in the seismic image, and they are extremely time-consuming and they're highly subjective. So even if they wanted to spend all the time trying to map these SBRs and they came up with, we think this is a cave, other people would say, no, it's not. Like, it's, again, this is an incredibly, incredibly imperfect science.
Yeah.
It's not what some people think it is. So it's kind of like the ocean too, where like the caves and the depths just aren't explored. And yet if you have theories or thoughts about them, shut up. Right.
Right.
And that brings me to, shout out to Pat Mo if he's watching. We were having a conversation last night and he said, have you ever done an episode about the, well to hell? And I was like, no, but I've heard about it and I found out it fits perfectly into this episode. So we're going to talk about this, well to hell in Siberia. Have you ever heard of it? It's kind of like a famous urban legend. Okay. So okay. In 1989, the Trinity Broadcasting Network, or TBN, you've probably heard of them, aired a story about a Russian drilling team that found the entrance to hell itself. And the story goes that a team of Soviet engineers led by Mr. Azakov drilled a hole 9 miles deep in Siberia before breaking into an unexpected cavity in the Earth's crust. So what they said is that the drill was going like it normally does, and it just starts spinning really fast, and they broke down into something they didn't expect. They thought that it was all solid, 9 miles down, thing breaks, they pull it back up, and the drill is just like super red hot. And they're getting heat coming out of this and readings off the charts. When that deep, they were not expecting it to be more than 100 to 150 degrees Fahrenheit tops, right? Like something the drill can easily handle. So they are start hearing this sound and they can't figure out what it is. So they turn off all the equipment and they're still hearing the sound. And
sounds like a Doctor Who episode. This is a Doctor Who episode.
Is this a Doctor Who episode?
Yeah, pretty sure it is.
Okay. Maybe it is. Maybe it is. It's there's a lot of movies and TV things that have been based on this. So they turn off all the equipment and it sounds like they're hearing the screams of dying humans. And they lower in this extremely heat-tolerant microphone along with this other sensory equipment into the well, and the temperature quickly reaches 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit before it just destroys the microphone and the sensory equipment that's gauging the temperature and all this stuff. And they said that they had recorded 17 seconds of sound that confirmed their worst fears. And I actually found the sound to play for you. So,
oh boy,
let's listen to it.
Searching.
Sorry, that's it. Essentially,
wow. I'm
sorry about the commercial popping up there, but yeah, it's this like screaming, wailing. Sounds like hell, right? And obviously, the story being hosted, you know, coming to America through TBN. Which is a Christian broadcasting network that's basically like, hey, we have proof that hell exists. It starts to like really pick up, getting a lot of calls. People are asking for more about this story. So they asked TBN where this came from, and they said that it was published by the Finnish newspaper. I don't even know why I'm trying. Ammattisastia, which they said was a well-respected newspaper in Finland. And this guy named, this researcher named Richard Bueller found that he wanted to see if they were right. So he calls this newspaper. He finds out it's actually a small journal that's published by a Pentecostal church in a small village that I can't pronounce. I left that off my notes. And they in turn said that they wrote this article based on a journalist's memory of an article that he read in a section of a newspaper titled Atella Sumomen. And this newspaper said that it basically had published a fictional account based on a Christian newsletter named Valtajet, which they had printed the story in 1989. And that newspaper's editor claimed that its origin had been a newsletter called Jewels of Jericho, which was published by a group of Messianic Jews in California.
The Jews!
So at this point, Richard Bauer stops following the trail. And there's a more that goes on where he like trolled TBN and proved that they weren't checking their sources and stuff like that. Mm. Also, the recording of the tormented screams that you heard that came out later, I think Coast to Coast AM is the original one who shared this after the story started becoming huge, was proven to be looped together from various sound effects, most coming from a soundtrack from a 1972 movie named Barren Blood.
Disappointing.
So pretty cool urban legend, but not true. There is, though, another well to hell, or thing that's nicknamed the well to hell, but it's better known as the Well of Barhut. And this is a sinkhole in Yemen. I've got actually a picture of this. Look how freaking huge this thing is.
Oh, it's massive.
Yeah, it is. It has a circular entrance that measures 30 meters wide at the surface, and it's 112 meters deep, and it widens out towards the bottom. And folklore of this area goes back a long way, that this is a prison for jinn, for genies, essentially, right? These evil spirits in Islam. And that was until, well, I mean, it's, the folklore still persists, but no one had ever been to the bottom of this thing until 2021. And that's when these cave divers from Oman were the first to reach the bottom. And inside, we can scroll down and see this. There's a view from the top. This thing's freaking massive.
It looks really like you'd expect it to look.
It does, right? It, like, I read the accounts of it, and then I looked at the pictures like, oh, that's way bigger than I even imagined in my head. So
yeah.
In it, they found like stalagmites. They found these things called cave pearls. That's where I was going to say, that looks like Nostoc. It's these giant green balls of snot looking things that are formed by water droplets. Yeah, okay. So we got some Nostoc in here. They found live snakes. They found dead animals. They found waterfalls.
Okay, I'm sorry. Wait. In the prison for evil jinn spirits, we found live snakes.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
And this is only a few years ago. So they took samples of the rocks, the soil, the water, the dead birds, all these things found in the cave. They didn't expect to be down there. And they said, we'll give a further analysis to the public at some later date. That was 3 years ago. And that's it. That's where the story sits right now. Just like, we found things down here we didn't quite expect. Living animals, its own, like, you know.
Yeah.
It has its own ecosystem, essentially, in this bottom of this giant pit. And it's not the only one. One that came out just 2 years ago. And we, I think, mentioned it on the show because it came out around the time we started the show, I feel like. Was this 2022 researchers in southern China found this giant sinkhole. And here's a picture of it, right? So from USA Today, it says, researchers also think, oh shoot, I got my notes out of order. This sinkhole is 1,000 feet deep. It's 500 feet in width and 630 feet in width at the bottom. So it's 500 feet wide at the top, 630 feet wide at the bottom, and it's 1,000 feet deep. So massive hole. Researchers from USA Today, it says, researchers also think there may be new species of animals and plants within the sinkhole, which is made up of three caves and measures 5 million cubic meters, the equivalent of 2,000 Olympic swimming pools. And again, this was just less than 2 years ago. And that's all we've really found out about it because it came out of China. So you can find these May 2022 articles all talking about it, showing a few pictures and a little bit of video. But what the researchers are saying, they're all saying, we have found, and we have not published, but we have found new creatures, new fauna down here. Those trees that you're looking at are 130 feet tall.
Holy crap.
Yeah. They're bigger than like trees generally grow, like that type of tree. I think those are palm trees. They're taller. Yeah, they're 130 foot tall palm trees. They're taller than oak trees generally grow on the surface. Like, this is its own ecosystem. And they said in China, they're expecting to find more. I think they said they found five so far. And this is the only one that we've really heard anything about. So this idea of these underground forests and these like different ecosystems under the earth are not quite so weird. Like, they're at least plausible, right? So like,
yeah,
the question then becomes like, is the science really settled? Like, is the earth hollow? I don't think it's hollow, like hollow, but is it completely settled that there couldn't be underground, you know, vegetation, animals, cities, ecosystems? And that's where I want to come back to a few concepts we already talked about. And the first one is magnetic declination. So that's the thing that we talked about. Edmund Halley was sailing around the ocean. He just swam everywhere with a compass in his hand. He is sailing around the ocean trying to figure out where the hell this comes from. And his theory was that we have the North Pole up here, but underneath the surface, there's another pole that's like drawing our compasses in a different direction. And it's constantly shifting and changing at a different pace than our Earth. And he's still laughed at by the scientific community for that belief. But the only forward answer I could get on the internet of this at all, because there's some people that say it has to do with stars. Like, this is an unsettled thing still, and he's being made fun of, but this is what they say. They say This comes from the Wisconsin State Cartographer's Office. It says, due to the dynamic nature of the Earth's interior, the magnetic field is constantly changing. This causes drift of magnetic north and oscillations of the magnetic meridian. This change in magnetic declination is called the annual change. So what they're saying is something underneath the Earth's surface is moving and drawing the magnetic pole that your compass is sensing in a different direction. Do you see where I'm going with this? It's like, this is what Edmund Halley said, right? The well to hell story that I set out of Siberia, even though the urban legend we heard is fake, this is actually based on a true story. And it's pretty weird. So the Kola super deep borehole in Siberia is still the deepest man-made hole in history. Mm. It reaches 7.6 miles deep. They started boring this and two other holes in 1970 and didn't finish until 1989. They set out to study the Baltic Shield, which is part of the continental crust that's underneath the continent of you know, Europe and Russia and stuff like that. Right. And they thought that it was 4 miles below where they were drilling based on seismological data. What they were saying was at 4 miles deep, which is not that deep. And
we should hit that. Yeah.
What they're saying is basically their seismographic waves are getting messed up. Like they're trying to go through something that they can't fully penetrate in a way. And again, what they're essentially saying is underneath 4 miles, we don't have a damn clue about what's down there, but we know everything. Right. So
yeah,
they drill down. Questions. Yeah. Don't ask questions. We know this Baltic Shield. We know all this stuff. At 4 miles, we're going to hit basalt. They drill 7 miles and they never hit basalt, but they still remained inside of granite at 7 miles down. It went completely against everything they thought they knew. And what's weirder is they found that as they got past that point, the water or the granite was saturated with water, that it was porous and full of water they never expected to hit. And then even before that, at 3.7 miles deep, they found microscopic plankton living in the Earth's crust they never expected to find. So they're finding water and life and not at all what they expected to find, that granite wasn't acting the way they thought it would. And even further, they found I don't think I put this in my notes, but they found like gas down there that was making the water boil and act in all these strange ways. So like the further they're digging, the more they're finding everything weirder, that their seismological data told them was not true, which is actually fine. I think this is how hypotheses go. And this is the part of the story that drives me nuts is I was listening to, again, a lot of scientists today and yesterday talk about this. And one of the quotes that kept coming up over and over again, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but what they would say is the hollow earth people won't believe what we tell them unless we dig up the earth and show them. And it's like, yes, but like, why is this a bad thing? Like that's my question, right? Is like, what we find out is that scientists hypothesize, then they find things to back up their data or change their data based on what they find by digging. And then the people who say, maybe we should dig and explore caves and we might not know everything, are laughed at and ridiculed. But again, time and time again throughout this whole thing, we keep coming to scientists don't actually know every single detail of thousands of miles below the Earth's surface. They don't actually know this.
Scientists have a long and glorious history of at every point in history thinking that they know everything and hating on and trying to silence people who think that maybe the world's a little bit weirder and a little bit more complex and a little bit more whatever than we thought. And then finally, those people are vindicated and proven right.
Right.
So why would it be any different now?
It's just the same old story time and time again. And then again, in 2014, we talked about this in the past a little bit. The understanding of what was underneath Earth's surface, a.k.a. settled science, was changed again in a huge way. And it's not even being talked about. I don't think it's being talked about enough. And that is that this violent volcanic eruption, they call it a kimberlite, which is basically like they equate it to dropping a Mentos in a Coke bottle. Like, just, poof, like these just huge unexpected eruptions, short-lived but crazy, basically shot these diamonds up out of the volcano in Botswana, Africa.
Yeah.
And they found and studied these kind of ugly greenish diamonds. And what they found was that this is called ringwoodite. It's a green crystal of ultra compressed water that's only ever before this point been witnessed in meteorites or created in laboratory settings. And basically what it is like, I'm not a scientist, so forgive me guys, but what I saw a video on is it basically takes H2O and makes it H3O by compressing it so much that then it then acts like a way they never expected, where it starts to form these symmetrical patterns and crystallize, and it holds water in the most dense form that could possibly happen. And that possibly a huge part of our Earth's crust, actually, this, we'll read a little bit in an article, or I'll show you a video on this in a second. That what they're now believing, again, after everything is silly, we don't really have water and life and all these things down in the Earth's core, is that we have more water underneath the surface of the Earth than on top of it by a lot.
Amazing.
And it's all compressed in this super crystallized water. And again, I know we talk about this with the flood stuff in the past, but basically, if you read the Bible, it says that the water came up from out of the earth.
Right.
And now we're realizing that magma and things like that could actually heat up ringwoodite and create geysers that could actually flood the earth, because there's more water underneath than on top of, the Bible in this case being thousands of years ahead of science. But this was 2014, and I just want you to watch the beginning. It's a 6-minute video, so I'm not gonna play the whole thing, but I want you guys to watch the beginning of this video and just note the tone of how it is when scientists discover things compared to when we speculate, when other people speculate things.
Scientists have found concrete evidence that there's a vast ocean beneath the Earth's surface. The idea of an underwater world has driven plenty of science fiction. But now, one group of researchers says it's not too far from science fact. They discovered an area inside the Earth's surface that's believed to hold many times more water than the rest of the Earth's oceans combined. If it turns out to be accurate, our models of how water appeared on Earth might need serious revisions. It would also be a turning point in our understanding of the interior of the Earth. But the intriguing question is how they found...
Yes, then he goes into the story I just told you. But don't you love how, in this case, it's, wow, we're wrong on literally everything, but we discovered it, and you idiots that wrote science fiction might have been right in so many ways, but now... Now it's okay to theorize based on a piece of crystal that came out of a volcano when it's not okay to theorize in the past. So beyond the ringwoodite, which we're starting to realize we don't actually know what all the layers are. There might be this giant massive water layer. They're finding other anomalies and starting to talk about it in recent years. This comes from 2022. And I'm not going to read the whole article. You guys can look this up yourself from the BBC and others, but it says, why are there continent-sized blobs in the deep earth? So again, we're finding just massive, huge continent-sized areas that we don't know what they are. Couldn't possibly anything to do with flat earth, couldn't be this, couldn't be that. But they'll posit that it's like distant space junk that, I don't know. There's like all these weird theories, but it's any theory besides, you know, ones that other people have proposed that they don't like. So let's exclude all evidence except the evidence that we like, essentially.
Renamed.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it when they just rename the theory. It's like, oh, this is our idea, you guys. Because they don't, the scientists don't mind when they're like, look at this breaking discovery we found.
As long as they're the ones to say it. Yes.
Right.
And then they never give people credit to people who are ahead of their time, which is actually literally the point of science fiction. The point of science fiction is to say, hey, here's where things might go. Let's play out that scenario. And that's why I feel like science fiction is so often like satirists, where they are coming up with things that we're going to see in the future. So this article comes from the SmithsonianMag.com, and it's called Inner Earth is Teeming with Exotic Forms of Life. And this, again, it's just like what we talked about last week with the mesosphere and them finding bacteria in the atmosphere that we never thought that life is finding a way, as Malcolm would say. So it says, ancient bacteria from nearly 2 miles below the Earth's surface, that's what first drew Tullis Onstott to begin his research for life in the most unlikely of places. The geomicrobiologist had just attended a 1992 U.S. Department of Energy meeting about rocks estimated to be more than 200 million years old. Older than most dinosaurs, these prehistoric rocks had been unearthed from a gas explosion, they said, had turned out to be teeming with bacteria. That's pretty amazing to me, says Princeton University's Onstott. The idea that these bacteria have been living in these Jurassic rocks since they were deposited at time prior to the age of dinosaurs, that idea caught my fancy. These rocks were among the first substantial evidence that life exists miles underground, and they jump-started researchers' effort to study life in the so-called deep subsurface. Over the past, this almost sounds like they're talking about inner earth theory. Over the past, almost exactly like that. Over the past 20 years, Onstott and others have found there is a greater variety of life in a lot more inhospitable places than anyone had imagined. deep life has been
anyone
found.
Than anyone had really the gall of these people.
You gotta love that sentence. Tons of people have imagined and posited this for thousands of years, but now in 2022, no one had ever thought. It's like Bush with 9/11, right? No one ever thought of them crashing planes into buildings.
Which is wild, because the part of the title or subtitle of this article is Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Right. Yes. Yeah, yeah. You got to love it. 1864. But no one had ever thought of this before. No one had ever thought before.
Zero people.
So it says, deep life has been found all over the world under a variety of conditions, in oil fields and gold mines, beneath ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica, in sediments and rocks below the ocean floor. These places can be extremely hostile environments with pressures 10 to 100 times that at the surface. Temperatures can range from nearly freezing to more than 140 degrees Fahrenheit. And a mile below the surface, there's no sunlight and very little oxygen. In these austere environments, creatures have to scratch out a living on whatever energy they can muster from their surroundings. This means the pace of life down there can sometimes be incredibly slow. It just goes on to just say, look, we keep finding life in all the places we've told you plebeians it's impossible until we find it. And this is funny, because from the scientific community, they're looking for life on the surface of Mars and saying that they really expect to find it. Just not in our atmosphere, not underneath our ground, not in hot places, not in cold places, but the extremes of a planet without an atmosphere, that's where they're going to find, like, that's where they expect to find it. And I think that's because they know something that they don't want to say.
Where they're afraid of finding something if they ask certain questions.
Yeah.
Or both.
Yeah. I just really quickly, I just realized there's one more paragraph in this that I did want to read, and it says, these creatures of the deep are diverse, consisting of bacteria and other single-celled organisms called archaea. There are even multicellular animals below the Earth's surface, including worms called nematodes. And that's what's in this picture. So again, if you think we're just talking about single-cellular organisms or bacteria, we're talking about at least worms. We're talking about at least multicellular animal life 2 miles below the Earth's surface. So sorry, go ahead.
I didn't say it last time, because I thought of it after the stream on Atmospheric Beast about how NASA originally was studying the ocean.
Right.
And then they go up and they study space. It's just, I don't know. There's something weird going on with, it's like, what is NASA actually studying is, I think, maybe the right question to be asking.
That's the funny thing, is NASA's involved in the Antarctica stuff. NASA's involved in deep sea stuff. NASA's involved in space stuff. Is the theme with NASA that they're trying to hide and obscure the origins and the availability of life? Is it? I really don't know. It's like, again, like NASA seems like all space organizations obsessed with finding bacteria on distant planets without atmospheres, but then absolutely hostile to anyone that thinks that there's bacteria in our sky. Oops, there is. There's bacteria and life and worms and animals and things underneath the Earth's surface. Oops, there is. What's in the ocean? What's in, you know, all this stuff? And it just seems to be like, whatever's happening on our planet, they don't want us to think about, is what it seems to be. The
look anywhere else.
Look anywhere but here.
Strange places of this Earth. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's interesting. So that's basically all I had for you guys on the Hollow Earth stuff. I want to reiterate that this is essentially the overlook of the Hollow Earth theory, and there's probably little things that we dug up in here that'll turn into future episodes. We definitely got to cover the Koreshian sex cult. No, but I think that there's a lot more here to dig on. So if you guys enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star review. It really helps the show. We'll read it on air, and come over to Discord. It's in the description. If you're listening to this on audio, it's in the description. If you're on anywhere you're watching this at all, and you can join a community over there of people who are talking, sharing ideas. And every now and then I will read through your ideas and actually come up with an episode that lots of people have asked for. So appreciate you guys for that. We will be back tomorrow night on Locals with a really interesting episode. So please come over to conspiracypill.locals.com, support the show, get a bonus episode. You don't want to miss it. Before we head over to Rumble and chat with people and read messages and look at all the memes they sent us, do you have anything you want to say about the Hollow Earth to our audio listeners and people on YouTube and stuff? They're going to show off YouTube here in a second.
This is we all deserve a good bonk for this episode. Just everybody this is like the church service. Like, look to your right and look to your left. Just give everyone near you a good, a good bong.
Yeah, I just want you guys to know Jesus read the chat tonight, so he's reading. He also listened to our stupid show. I don't know if I should apologize for the mom jokes, but they were at least entertaining. So
yeah.
All right. We're going to head over to Rumble. So if you're watching this on Facebook, on YouTube, on anywhere besides Odyssey, Rockfin, and Rumble, then we're going to be shutting this off in a minute. And we're going to be reading your chats and chatting with the audience for a little while. We'll see if Baby Esau has anything to say. So thank you, Abby. Thank you, everybody, for watching and listening. We will see you guys in a minute. Have a great night, everyone. God bless.